coming out this morning. I am Courtney Lytle. I am a local attorney. I'm mainly into academics these days. I teach at Emory Law School, and I have been doing intellectual property law of various sorts for more years than I care to admit. Today, what we're going to do is I'm going to talk to you a little about copyright. That's why we called it Copyright 101. What we're going to start with is the basics of what copyright is and isn't, okay? So I'll give you all a good grounding in what it is. I know a lot of y'all have questions that may be fairly specific, but let me get through my overview, because that actually answers about half the questions usually. So let me get through my stuff, and then I promise I will leave time for questions. If you have questions as we're going through about what I just said, like, wait a minute, that makes no sense at all, please raise your hand and stop me. I'm fine with that. If you have questions about something you want to know, we'll have time at the end. Okay? Rock. Okay, copyright law. We're going to start with what it's not. It's not sciencey stuff. That's a technical term. Try not to get too confused with sciencey stuff. Patents cover inventions, machines, pharmaceuticals, all of those things that really smart scientists do. The lawyers who do patents are also really smart, because unlike those of us who, I took astronomy for my science, and that was quite challenging enough. Most lawyers, if you want to kind of make a lawyer both cringe and laugh, tell them the traditional joke, well, yeah, but if you could do math and science, you'd be a doctor. And it's true. So we have a little bit of MD envy usually. The patent lawyers are different. They can do science and math, and we are kind of intimidated by them because they're way smarter than us. They take a separate exam. If any of you guys do have an invention or a machine or anything along those lines that you think needs to be patented, you need to talk to a patent lawyer. Ask them if they are a patent lawyer. There are things that I can do in patent law, but for the most part, to be a full, honest-to-God certified patent lawyer, you have to take a separate bar exam. It is one of the only specialties in law where that's the case. I could hang out a shingle tomorrow and say, I'm an estate lawyer. I'd be a really bad one because I know little to nothing about estate law, but I'm allowed to do that. I am not allowed to pretend to be a patent lawyer. To be a patent lawyer, you have to have taken the patent bar. So if any of you do have a patent, you can't file it yourself, it won't work. If it's something you care about enough to do it, you really need an honest-to-God patent lawyer, and they are really, really expensive. It will cost you between $10,000 and $30,000 to file a patent. Patents give you great protection. It's really expensive and difficult to get them because writing out the claims and all those things are very technical. That's why the patent lawyers have to understand the science, because I would say, you know, this claim involves blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I would have no idea what I was writing. That's why patent lawyers have science backgrounds. You had a patent question?
Where does software fall?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Software is kind of the ugly stepchild of the IP industry. There are software patents. I think there have probably been panels here about why that's evil. Some software can be patented if it is, if the patent office will accept it. I would try to explain the distinction between patentable and non-patentable software, but it's murky at best. Some software can be patented. The big problem with that is it takes so long. By the time your patent issues, your software is probably obsolete. But software also can be subject to copyright, which is, in my mind, even worse, because it really doesn't belong there at all. And I'll get to that in a second. But software is covered by copyright automatically, can be covered in some circumstances by patent. And you would need to talk to an attorney. That one doesn't even have to be a patent lawyer. It can be a regular IP lawyer about whether your software would be likely to qualify for the extra steps. So for the most part, those are your patents. They're expensive, you've got to have a lawyer. And there are patent clerks. Many of them are very bright and capable, but frankly, if I had an invention that I really had cared about and cared enough to try to drop the $30,000 to get a patent on, I would get a real lawyer. And make sure, like I said, that you're not getting an IP lawyer who is not a patent lawyer. That's the patent stuff. Now we're done with that. Trademarks. Trademarks we all know. I'm drinking out of a generic bottle. Someone has a red bottle with a swoosh. No? Really? No Coke products? Man, they're going to dock us our salaries. Okay, I need a trademark. Show me a trademark. There we go. Yay, a Coke bottle. Oh, phew. I was afraid I was going to be taken out and whipped. If there are no Coke products in a panel, we all get hurt. This is Atlanta, where the shadow of the Big Red Tower. This is the best trademark ever, benign overlords. Coca-Cola. If I buy this bottle, I know what's in it. Well, I don't, because the formula is secret. That's a trade secret. That's different. We'll get there in a moment. But if I buy this something with the distinctive red lettering and the swoosh, I know that I am buying something from the Coca-Cola company. It will have caramel color, which people say now is cancerous, but it's not benign overlords. It's lovely. And there's caffeine, the source of all life and good things. I know what I'm getting. That's what trademarks are all about. Here, pass this back to whoever I stole it from. It's more fun in the morning to have someone up in the front clutching desperately a cup of coffee and grab it out of their hands than go, as I walk around with it for a few moments. Thank you for the Coke. So a trademark is really consumer protection. Patent is about in protecting the invention, sort of, kind of. Trademark is about you. This is the part of law that's all about you. It's lovely, isn't it? Trademark means when I buy something off the shelf, I know what I'm getting. If I buy a Toyota car, I know I'm getting something made by Toyota Manufacturing in Japan. If I buy a Coca-Cola, I know I'm getting a Coke. If I buy a Pepsi, I know I'll be in trouble because I live in Atlanta. But I know what I'm buying. That's what trademark is. You can trademark and protect it, your brand name, your company name, if it is linked to the provision of goods and services. So if I have a company that's, you know, doing computer software repairs or something, if I have a towing company, if I have a soft drink company, I'm going to want to trademark my logos, my names, my slogans, and those sorts of things, so no one else can use my logo or my trade dress. You know, Coca-Cola has that very distinctive female-shaped bottle. Yeah, really, it's a coincidence. It looks like a woman's, yeah, at any rate. So they have trademarked that shape of their bottle. Anything that identifies your company's product can be trademarked. It can be color, it can be music, it can in some cases be a scent, but that one's a little hard. Even color is difficult. Coke, for instance, could not trademark that kind of brown caramel color because that's the color cola is. You can't trademark orange labels for an orange soda. Coke is actually one of the examples of what also happens to trademarks that actually are too successful. They originally started making their cola-flavored drink, and they're actually a very generic name, Coca-Cola. It was made out of coconuts and cola beans. It's a very descriptive name, but it's become very distinctive because we all know what it means. They lost Coke. No, they lost cola. Coke is still theirs, and they're trying very hard to keep it. Cola used to be their distinctive trademark also, but everyone started using it to mean that flavored drink. Cola is now a generic word, and Coke doesn't own it anymore. Unless your mark becomes generic like that through overuse, or you stop using your trademark lasts forever and ever, amen. As long as you use your trademark, it keeps going. Those are trademarks. Trade secret, which also is Coke, is another way to keep things like formulas or business methods secret. It's just what it says. It's a secret. How do you keep a secret? You don't tell anyone. And if you do tell them, you make them sign a non-disclosure. You keep the formula locked up. Literally, there's a big vault in the CEO's office. The formula's in it in Coke. No kidding, the original formula is still there in a vault. If you want to keep your trade secret secret, you keep it secret, and then the law helps protect you against people stealing it. That one also doesn't expire, and there's not, and it's only as good as your security practices. Those are not copyright. So now we're done with everything we're not talking about today. It only took 15 minutes. Copyright is the artsy stuff, the creative stuff. And because Congress made a mistake in my mind, it's software as well. So copyright is your novels, it's your music, it's your films, it's your sculpture, it's your paintings, it's your fan fiction. It's all sorts of things that are creative. So patent is your sciencey stuff, trademark is your brand names, trade secrets are whatever you want to keep secret. There's rules, but it's not interesting enough to talk about. And copyright is all the artsy and creative stuff. Copyright actually is in the Constitution along with patents. When the Founding Fathers were making up all the rules that we live by now, they noticed that one of the things they had done was kind of do away with the ruling class and the ruling church. And someone at the meantime noticed, who pays for all the artwork? Who commissions all the music? Who are all the scientists? They're all the ruling class that don't have to work, and the church commissions all the art, and the monarchs commission the rest of it. Oh crap, we'll have no art or science in our new community. And so they said, well, let's go with what we do have, which is an open market. So they decided to protect both sciencey stuff, the patents, inventions, and music, and books, and art by giving the creators a government-sponsored monopoly for a limited amount of time in their creation. It is not, and this matters more on an academic level, but I'm academic, so, you know, we're going to do that. But it kind of matters in some of the weird results that don't always make sense. We don't think of copyright as the author's possession. Property, we understand. This is my water bottle because I bought it, and so it's mine. Okay, that's easy. We all have property. Intellectual property seems to make sense, too. I created this, so it's mine. That's not how the law works. That's called the sweat of the brow doctrine. I made it, so it's mine. But actually, if I'm not mistaken, the first spoken line in Mad Max, like Road Warrior, was, it's my snake, I trained it, and I'm going to eat it. That comes like 80 minutes into the movie. And but that's the natural law version of property law. It's my snake, I trained it, and I'm going to eat it. I wrote this book, so it's mine. No. I wrote this book, and the government has decided it's in everyone's interest for books to be written, so the government is kindly granting me a temporary monopoly in the book that I wrote. After a certain period of time, anyone can use it. They did that, too, because they knew that even starving artists need occasionally to eat, and they wanted to make sure there was some profit motive for people to create or to invent. That's the idea behind copyright. It's not yours because you made it. In Europe it is, but not here. So copyright, like I said, is the creative stuff, but it has to have come out of your head. I have more times than you can imagine have people have, I have this great idea, how do I protect it? So we'll write it down. They stole my idea. Well, no, even if they knew it was your idea and they used it, that's fine. Ideas are not protectable. Expressions of those ideas are. So my idea about this great novel that I'm going to write is not protected at all. Even though the novel will be great, I promise, you'll love it. But right now, none of it has been written, so there's no protection whatsoever. On the other hand, these lovely and detailed notes that I write for my panel presentations and then never look at, these are protected by federal copyright law. Now, I assure you, I am not so neurotic that I filed this in Washington. I had the ideas of what I was going to say, and I wrote them down. Writing them down is fixing my expression in a tangible medium. We call it writing it down. Lawyers call it fixing my expression in a tangible medium. And it is covered automatically by federal copyright law. I do not have to file anything. Trademark you have to file. One thing I forgot to say when I was talking about trademarks, see I should have looked at my notes, is if you do have a trademark that you want to protect, you can do the filing yourself. It's more complex. It's more complex than a copyright, but it's not nearly as hard as a patent. If you want to file your own trademark, you can do it, okay? USPTO.gov, read the FAQs, it kind of walks you through. They have really helpful attorneys on that you can call and ask. Your tax dollars paid for them, so you may as well use them. You cannot ask them legal questions. Should I do it this way? What's the best way? You can't ask them that, but I don't understand what this section means. What am I supposed to put in there? They'll help you with. And they're really very helpful. Except for a couple who are jerks, if you get them, hang up, say thanks so much, hang up and call back, you'll get someone else and they'll be helpful. Mm-hmm. Copyright, you don't even have to file. Upon fixation, when you write it down, when you carve it, when you paint it, it is protected under federal copyright law. However, if it's something you really care about, if it's that novel, file it. Filing is easy. It's copyright.gov. They made even that part easy. And there is a very simple form you fill out, you send in a copy, and you're done. They also have happy lawyers that will talk to you if you're confused by it, but it's a simple, simple form. There are a few terms of art you might not know. They'll tell you what they mean, the FAQs will tell you what they mean, and honestly, it's simple.
Does it have to be a physical copy, or can it be an electronic copy now?
It depends. By the way, if you ever take a law school class, it depends is the best answer ever because it's always right and it gives you time to stop and think, crap, what's the real answer? But in this case, the answer really is it depends. Sometimes they want you to send a physical copy. Sometimes they are perfectly happy to get an electronic copy and they will tell you which they want. If you've made a huge sculpture, for instance, what are you going to send? They change their regs from time to time. In fact, I just learned yesterday they've raised the rate since the last time I filed one. It was 35, now it's 60. But still, $60 is all you're paying. Compare that to the $30,000 you're paying for your patent. Copyright's a bargain, and you don't have to pay a lawyer. You pay the filing fee, you send in a copy. Now, if you're writing the great American novel, and like so many other novelists, you haven't actually found someone to purchase or publish it, you can nevertheless impress your friends by saying that your novel is part of the permanent collection of the Library of Congress. Because by virtue of filing your copyright, you send them a copy, and they put it somewhere in a warehouse next to the Ark of the Covenant. Don't look for it on the shelves of the Reading Room and the Jefferson Room at the Library of Congress, don't get me wrong. But you can honestly say that your book is now part of the Library of Congress permanent collection. That's how they started the library, actually. They had a lot of donations from rich people with books. Those were the only people who had books then. But they also started with copyrights when the Constitution was ratified. They said, okay, if you want the copyright, you have to send us a copy. That's how they got their books. They said, well, you don't get a copyright unless you give us a copy. You know, it's kind of like,
can I have a copy of your book without paying?
Yeah, they said, ha ha, you want a copyright? We want a book. So they didn't have to pay for any. I thought that was kind of clever. Okay, copyright. So it is what we've written down. And again, an important key is as soon as you write it down, it's covered. But you can't sue to protect it, and really you don't have... my lawyer's mind just says, okay, yeah, it's as a technical matter of law, it's protected, but if I want to prove it's protected, I really want to have a certificate saying I filed it. So if it's something you care about, spend the $60, file the silly copyright file. Now, you don't have to do each chapter as you write. No one's going to sneak into your house and steal the book while you're writing it, I assume. I mean, if you're really famous, they might. There's a copyright case we'll talk about where that happened. But it was to Gerald Ford, not to a normal human. And it was from his publisher's office, not even his home. So don't worry about the work in progress as a general rule. Each step is technically covered by copyright law. As you create the sculpture, as you write the book, you're protected. When you're done, file it, because your protection is better. Many of you will have heard of the poor man's copyright. Who's heard of that? Always a few, yeah. Forget you have ever heard about it. It is complete garbage. The poor man's copyright, for those of you who haven't heard this, is that you put the you put your book, your whatever, in an envelope and mail it to yourself and don't open the envelope. This accomplishes nothing except giving some money to the government for an envelope that you mailed. Absolutely no legal effect whatsoever. None. People will tell you otherwise, they're wrong. I kind of associate that in my mind with something. When I first taught first aid classes, they taught us that we were supposed to insist to our students that they never put butter on a burn. That seemed very random to me, because they didn't mention other condiments. So apparently mustard on a burn would be fine, but butter was right out. Had anyone actually heard the like folk thing of put butter on a burn? Yeah, I had never heard that. So it seemed so very random to me that they were telling me not to do it. Well, don't put butter on a burn. That's also very wrong. Honey actually is good. But neosporin is better. Honey is like if you're stuck out in the jungle and don't have any medicine.
And mustard as well.
Mustard, I suppose, is fine because the Red Cross did not tell me to instruct you not to use mustard. But just like butter on a burn is a foolish thing to do, so is mailing yourself your letter or your book. Just spend the $60 and protect it for real. It's going to cost you that much to mail it now anyway. So poor man's copyright does not exist. Poor man's copyright is filed with the Library of Congress. $60, really, it's not that bad. Okay, so what is the protection you get once you've filed your copyright, your book, your art, your music, whatever you have filed? You get a list of rights. One of them is the right to make derivative works. That's the one where fair use, which many of you have heard of, comes in. But the right to make derivative works is the right to make translations, to take your novel and make a screenplay, and take your screenplay and make a film. The right to, you know, take a painting and turn it into a coffee table book of art. Taking your work and making something else. A sequel counts as well. A sequel, a prequel, I suppose, with George Lucas, whatever you want to do, it all counts. Those are derivative works. You as the author have the right to do that. Now, I'm going to say author because that's the legal term and because frankly most of my clients are authors, not artists. Although I'm working with the art show now, so I'm getting artists as well. It's kind of amusing. But author is the legal term. The creator of the work is the author. Even if the work is a painting, to lawyers like me, you may call yourself a painter or an artist, we call you an author. So author is an encompassing term today. So the author of the work owns the copyright and owns the work. The author has the right to distribute it, to perform it, to make copies of it, to make derivative works. Those are the main ones. There's others in there, but that's the big thing. Anything I want to do with my work is pretty much mine. Now, it's limited a bit. Oh, goody, a book. I'm stealing this from you. I just stole this, so this is mine. Okay, someone wrote this book. There's this notes. There's notes. We're going to pretend this is a novel. Some author wrote this book. And he bought it. Now, I stole it. That's a different class. That's sales class. But he bought the book, so this copy of the book is his. He has the right to do almost anything he wants with this copy of the book. This tangible piece is his. The work within it, the novel that was written inside here, still belongs to the author. He doesn't have the right to make a copy of this. He has the right to burn it. He has the right to stomp on it, to put it under the treads of a truck. He has the right to give it to a friend. He has the right to be foolish enough to let some chick in the front of a classroom steal it from him. He has the right to do whatever he wants with this tangible copy. But he can't use the intangible stuff inside. Does that make sense? The derivative work part of it comes in as well. If the art on the front was really cool, he can't take this art off the front and do something else with the book cover. So there's limits on what you can do with your tangible copy, but an important thing is, first sale doctrine, there's your legal term, is once he bought this copy of this book, he owns this physical copy. He can resell it, unlike, you know, anything made by Microsoft. He owns it and he can resell it or give it away. He can't copy it, though. He can destroy it if he wants. Thank you. Mm-hmm. See, I gave that one back. Sometimes I don't. Yes?
Can he cut it up and put it on a painting?
Probably not. That's making a derivative work. However, that issue is a really funny one because there are, that goes into fair use, which we'll get to in a second, but there's a conflicting line of cases. Just in case you thought that lawyers actually knew answers, yeah, we don't. There are cases that say if I legitimately buy a postcard of a piece of art that was, you know, licensed by the artist, author, I own that physical copy of the postcard, right? So if I take that physical copy of the postcard, don't make a copy of it, which is I can't do, but take that and put it on a tile and sell it in a gift shop. That apparently was a big thing for a while because there's a lot of cases about buying postcards of art or prints of art, shellacking it onto a piece of tile and selling it in a gift shop. Who knew? But there are lots of cases about that. And you know what? About half of them say that's a derivative work and that's the author's individual right. No, you can't do that. That's copyright infringement. And the other half say, oh, that's fair use. That's fine. So whether you can cut up the cover of that book and put it on a painting, you don't know until the judge tells you, frankly. We seem to be going down that rabbit hole. Let's talk about fair use. Fair use is something that a lot of people are interested in. In fact, I'm talking about it alone for an hour after this. But fair use is not an actual right that you have. And if you think that, no, you're wrong. Fair use does not mean, yes, I can take this thing that I like and write about it. People think, oh, I'm allowed to write my fan fiction about Kirk and Spock. I'm allowed to draw pictures of the guy who played the Hobbit in the movies. I'm allowed to do that because it's fair use. Yeah, no, you're infringing. It's illegal. Now, fan art is, frankly, infringement. Most of the content owners, most of the studios, most of the, you know, famous authors have figured out, after doing it wrong for a while, that going after you guys is really stupid. Because writing fan fiction and stuff is what people who come to Dragon Con do in between movie releases, in between series, because they're really excited about Star Trek or Hobbits or whatever you're excited about. You like to create things. You like to build the costumes. The TARDIS just left. There's a TARDIS in the back room for a minute. Okay, by the way, copyright and trademark infringement in the back of the room there for a little bit. But, you know, as a general rule, the content owners have figured out that if you sue the guy who built the TARDIS to walk around in Dragon Con in, you're pissing off, wait, your customers! That's bad for business. And honestly, him building a TARDIS and walking around in it is not harming them in any way. And someone finally beat enough sense into their heads to realize that even if I'm posting my fan fiction of Kirk and Spock on my website, that means all six of my friends can read it at once. I don't have to give it to them individually. But that's when the studios got a little crazy. When they realized that instead of just being a room of six people reading these fan fiction scripts at conventions like this, suddenly everyone could read them on the internet. First, they realized, yeah, we don't have that many friends. And second, they realized that we're their customers. We do this because we love their stuff, and if you piss us off, we're going to stop loving your stuff. And they realized that the internet did not mean that there was going to be no value left to their movies. The internet was just how we were keeping our excitement going between movies. And so for the most part, although your fan fiction is illegal, it is infringement for the most part, they don't care. There are limits. I'll get right to you guys in a second. There are limits. J.K. Rowling did not go after all of the 12-year-olds in the world, all of whom put up fan sites because 12-year-olds were the only ones who could do websites back when her books came out. So they all put up their little MySpace pages and everything else about all the Harry Potter stuff because every single one of them in the world had read it. And so had we. So J.K. Rowling and Scholastic did not go after those 12-year-olds or us because they said, oh, look, they're really keeping their excitement going. We've got 7 books coming out. Let's keep them excited so they keep buying every book. There was an exception to that. They took kind of the rational approach to fan fiction. They said, we could sue them. We could make them take it down. But, you know, it's like kicking a puppy. It seems mean. But there was I think he was a 14-year-old kid, who put together a really impressively done compendium encyclopedia of Hogwarts and the entire Harry Potter universe. And it was really good. And they made him take it down. And they slapped the lawyers on him saying, don't even think about mentioning it ever again or we will have to kill you. Because that was something they might want to make one of. They think that, because Scholastic already figured out, 7 books and she's done, people are still going to want to buy stuff. Hey, encyclopedias are always a way to sucker the fans into buying crap. Let's make sure we have the right to still do one. And if this kid had done one, which was really as good as anything that they were going to put out professionally, that might actually impact their ability to sell that later. So they stomped on him and made him quit. Now, my understanding is they didn't actually make him pay them money or anything. They just said, dude, no, take it down. So that's where the line usually gets drawn by where they enforce it. But keep in mind, this is not where the line is drawn by the law. This is how much the content holders tend to let you get away with. You have no right to do any of the MySpace crap, but they don't care. They care when it starts to potentially cost them money, generally. Nate had a question.
So that financial impact is not explicitly codified in any copyright law? Or does there have to be some sort of threshold?
Okay, there are 4 factors that we go through to distinguish copyright, to distinguish if it's fair use. We can talk about them, I don't know if we'll have time. When do we start? 1:30? We may have time. I could go through the 4 factors. Commercial impact is one of them. Whether your use is commercial or non-commercial counts, but is not dispositive. So if it's a non-commercial use, it is more likely to be a fair use, but a non-commercial use can still be an infringement. That's not an absolute test. It's one of the things that go into the very murky test that comes out the other end and no one knows till a judge tells you. And when I say a judge tells you, understand fair use is not a right that you have. Fair use is a defense to an action against you for infringement. So when you are guilty of infringement, you can say, yes, but. It's kind of like, you know, killing someone is not legal, but when you're charged for murder, you can raise the affirmative defense of self-defense.
But fair use is not, specifically, it's not an infringement.
It becomes not an infringement.
Yes.
It was an infringement until it became a fair use. What you do for a fair use is basically making a derivative work. Remember I was talking about translations and other things, and maybe posting a postcard to a tile might or might not be an infringement, might be a fair use. We don't know until the judge tells us. But your right to use other people's stuff is a really both murky and it is, there's a lot of conflict amongst people who are experts in the field. A lot of people think that the fair use right should be much broader than it is. A lot of people think the fair use right is broader than it is, and that's kind of where I want to make sure that you guys understand. Not that there's something wrong with doing fan fiction. There's not. It's great. But technically, unless you can convince a judge that it was a fair use, until you convince the judge it's a fair use, it's an infringement. Does that make sense? If you're right and it was a fair use, then it wasn't an infringement in the first place. But you have that burden of convincing the judge. Until you convince them it's a fair use, it's an infringement. And that's more of a legal thing. But I don't want you guys to put something up on the web and get smacked down by a content holder and be surprised by it. Understand, most of what you're going to post, if you're just doing fan fiction and things like that, is probably fine, because they don't mind. If you're really trying to make your first great novel, don't make it with Star Trek characters. If you're a talented author, make your own characters. Don't waste your time, frankly, recreating someone else's stuff. Do that for fun. Do that to hone your craft. But when you're ready to really make money and publish that first novel, make it your own. Because if you have the talent to write, you have the talent to create too. Don't sell yourself short. Make your own stuff. Now, using other people's things, especially in a digital age, is again something that has a bit of conflict behind it. There's a huge movement. Lawrence Lessig was one of the leaders of it, Creative Commons. These are folks who think that things should be shared. And I bring up Creative Commons because a lot of y'all are artists and authors, and you want people to be able to use your stuff. There's a sharing community. Amongst the software people, it's even broader. But amongst artists and creators, a lot of people think, well, sure, I'd love you to find my piece of artwork on the internet. Hey there, Creative Commons license. A lot of things are actually released under a Creative Commons license. It looks just like this.
Huh? And the video and audio will be as well.
Yay. It's released under a Creative Commons license. If I haven't said it before, I will say it now. Usually any contract or legal advice you download for free from the internet is worth exactly what you paid for it. This, however, is great. Creative Commons was written by really smart people who are actually also very good lawyers. The Creative Commons licenses are fabulous, and they are easy to understand. If you want to release your book and say, I want people to be able to copy it and to use it, but I just want them to attribute it. I want them to say it came from me. There's a license on the Creative Commons website that does exactly that. You release it under that Creative Commons thing, you put the Creative Commons mark where they tell you to put it, and it's telling the world, you can use this stuff, but just say it's mine. Or one variation of it is, you can use this stuff, but only for non-commercial use. That's what this one is? Use whatever you want out of this book, unless it's a commercial use, then you better get our permission. Which is
share alike as well.
That's a share alike as well. So, I wrote a textbook, and I may be the only person at the con who's not going to say, buy my book, because my book's a textbook, don't buy my book. But I have a chunk in it from Lawrence Lessig, because law students, for some reason, don't tend to be taught about copyleft. I think it's cool, and I think there's a great place for it. And unfortunately, because it would make a much better story the other way, Lawrence Lessig walks the walk. I wanted to use a chunk of his book because he explained his whole philosophy and the evolution of it much better than I could go back and re-explain it, because his copyright was not his ideas, not his thoughts, not his facts, but his expression of those ideas. Remember that expression thing? So if I write a history book, you can use the facts out of it freely. You just can't use the way I explained them. I wouldn't want to anyway. It's much too wordy. But Lawrence Lessig explained a lot of stuff. Now, I could have gone back and taken every fact out of his chapters and phrased it in my own odd way and been fine. But I thought, you know, I want him to speak for himself. He'll explain it better than I do. So I wanted to use his chapter. Now, I'm used to being an academic, so I just put that in there, was moving along. And my editor said, did you get permission to do that? And I said, well, it's academic use, which is when I realized that you can be really proud of yourself for being a copyright lawyer, but you can still be really stupid. Because, it's academic use, but it's going in a textbook that they're going to sell. That's commercial. I had to get permission to use it. Because his license was a non-commercial use. You know, use however you want, and he has free copies of it on his website.
There's a little bit of chapter
about Lessig, right? Yeah, there's one. Lawrence Lessig. And I thought it'd be really cool if I asked him for permission to use it, and he said no. Or he charged me a lot of money. I thought that would be great, because then I could show that he was a real hypocrite. Yeah, no. Not only did he say, of course, use whatever you want, use as much of that book as you would like, I'm happy that you're spreading the word, he got back to me within 24 hours of when I sent the email. He's very famous and very busy. I'm not. And he got back to me with a very courteous and gracious email like that. Which, I mean, is nice for him, but doesn't make as good a story. So the Creative Commons licenses are fabulous. And if you want to allow people to use your stuff, use these. Because they keep ownership rights in you, but you let other people share it. And that whole sharing community and sharing concept is a valuable one and a growing one. And it's good, because one of the ways that your work will get spread is if people see it and use it. Yeah?
If I put a piece of work out in the world with a Creative Commons license, attached to it,
uh-huh.
Do I later have the right to withdraw or amend that license, or I put it out there and it goes forever?
Well, technically,
make it wide but not really more free. Sometimes.
Sort of. There's different schools of thought on that. Let me tell you mine, which is if you release it under a license, you can stop releasing it under that license, but you know what? It's already out there, and anything that's already out there under that license can't be pulled back. So the idea that someone can copy the ones you already had out but can't copy the ones you put out from now on doesn't make a whole lot of practical sense. So from a technical legal standpoint, I believe that yes, you can say, okay, I am no longer releasing this under a Creative Commons license, but you cannot retroactively revoke the rights that you gave away to people who have already copied it. Does that make sense? And anything they have is still, yeah, anything behind you, anything downstream from you, is still freely usable. So you could say from now on, no one else is allowed to copy my work, but you can copy the copies of my work that are already out. So, although like I said, I believe it's a technical legal measure, you can. On a practical level, you can't really, because it's already out there. So think about how many rights you want to give, but, and now if it's a novel, there are legitimate, honest-to-God, commercial publishers who are releasing free copies online. Bain is a huge publisher. They commonly put out books free online. There are authors who are incredibly successful who firmly believe that putting the copies of their books out free creates an audience. There are old-school authors who say, everyone who downloads it for free is someone who didn't buy it. Every free copy is costing me money. There are other authors who firmly believe every free copy I give away creates at least one, maybe two people who are purchasing my work in the future. The people who are doing that are making a lot of money. People who aren't doing it, some of them are making a lot of money. So I, you know, the jury is still out in some ways, but there's a whole lot of theory that is not wrong that says give some stuff away and then people will come buy it. Think of it as just our modern way of marketing. You've got to make people know it's there. If you let people buy your first book, they'll like it. Now, usually my students in the past, I assigned the Lessig book, not just the chapter that's in my text, but I assigned the book. And about half of them buy his book and about half of them just download it. I have a couple copies of it because I like reading a book. I like, especially if I'm going to be teaching out, I like being able to flip pages, not scrolling. But I'm very old. I was educated when dinosaurs roamed the earth. I like paper. But you know what? I've been sucked into using a Kindle, and I like carrying a little bitty tablet on an airplane, not six books. So they're even winning me over. That tells you e-books are here to stay. When I go over, that's it. I'm not the early adopter. I'm the last adopter, and I do it. Yes?
So earlier you had mentioned derivative work, including translations.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this also speaks to fair use. There are lots of web applications now that let you add captions to published YouTube videos for accessibility, that kind of thing. And they basically just, the applet overlays the captions over the YouTube stream, so you're not posting the content.
Right.
What might the legal concerns be of making those captions available? And then, if you were to instead overlay critical commentary captions, would that change the concerns?
Okay, criticism is one of the express uses allowed as a fair use. But usually if you're doing a criticism of something, they mean for you to publish an article that's a critique. And what they had in mind was you can excerpt pieces as part of your critique. They didn't usually mean you can reproduce the entire movie. In fact, Riff Tracks, I think is what they're called, is the Mystery Science Theater guy's way of doing it without reproducing the movie, which is a copyright violation if it's not licensed. They just give you their riff track and say, just start it when you start the movie and, you know, play them both together and no one's broken any laws. Yay. So putting, like, captioning, like translation or hearing impaired sort of captions on it?
Basically just having a web page that accesses the YouTube stream that the author already made available.
Mm-hmm.
And then overlays the
You are making a derivative work of that author's work. That in itself is a infringement of that author's copyright. Now, if it's on YouTube, you know, there's what, a 30% chance that it's actually that author's work? It's probably infringement when you put it up. But chances are what you have just done is an infringement. Whether that counts as a fair use or not, I don't know. That's an interesting one because you're not, all of it's non-commercial use. It's using the entire part of the work, which is bad. But your work is actually not replacing the work in the audience. It's enhancing the work, and it's for a non-commercial sort of educational or accessibility sort of purpose, that might well be determined to be a fair use. But what I'm going to tell you guys, anytime you want to use someone else's stuff, even for that, I think that would be a fair use, but I don't know.
Is that not under JP?
Under what?
The
JP
amendment?
Oh, you're going to have to tell
me what you mean. It should be an amendment from the Copyright Act that you can try to make something accessible for educational platforms and it is fair use.
I don't know that his YouTube videos are even educational. I'm not familiar with that particular amendment. But it might well be within that, and it's an arguably it's educational. I don't know, if you're doing music videos, there's not much educational value in that. But accessibility, that's the sort of thing that would likely be a fair use. And there may be an amendment to the law that I didn't know about that would cover it. Could be. That sort of thing is, that sort of part is going to be probably safe, but let me tell you the easiest way to make sure you don't run afoul of copyright law. Ask permission. You know what? They'll usually give it to you. If they give you permission to do this, write the author of it an email saying, hey, do you mind if I post your thing with closed captioning so people can hear it or people can see what's on it? They'll probably say, hey, that'd be cool. Yes. Ask permission. If they give you permission, then you're not having to decide, oh gosh, it's going to fall within the fair use thing. And remember, it's not fair use till a judge tells you. You get out of trouble if you ask. I could have put Lessig's chapter in my book saying, well, it's a Creative Commons license, and this is sort of a academic use, but my publisher quite correctly said, dude. And I said, yep, right, okay. So I wrote him an email and said, dude, can I use your chapter? He said, of course, use it. Look, I'm not having to rely on fair use. I'm legally using his work. Pretty much one of the things that judges will look at is, could you have gotten permission? Scholarly works, which I cite all the time, there are a couple clearinghouses. That there was a Laval article, a judge wrote an article about fair use that I cited in my book, because he's more famous than I am, so his words were valuable. And he wrote a very elegant piece about just how screwed up fair use is. And he didn't, for instance, use the words screwed up. And I was like, do I have to track him down? Well, no. There is a clearinghouse for scholarly works that is, you know, basically all the publishers use them. You call CCH and say, I would like to use this work. They say, well, how do you want to use it? How many copies are you going to sell? I was like, dude, it's a very small legal text. I'm going to sell a few. And they said, okay, we will give you a license to use it for, you know, I think it was $30. Mm-hmm. So if I had used Judge Laval's article without permission, one thing the judge would have looked at was, oh, come on, you couldn't make one phone call to CCH and pay $30? Yeah, that's an infringement because you could have very easily gotten permission. So ask. Oftentimes, artists are happy to let you use their stuff or look for something that was released under a Creative Commons license because that means that they want you to use it. So there are a lot of ways to avoid the risk of getting in trouble. I think you were next.
So I see pretty often on websites, they'll see the copyright so-and-so on somebody's personal blog, something mm-hmm. like that.
That's correct.
For anybody that does maintain kind of like digital works like that on the internet, what are the implications? Copyright-wise of release, like if somebody, you automatically have copyright ownership of it.
If you post something on your blog, it is yours, you have a copyright. There is no requirement that you put the C with the circle and the date and your name at the bottom. I recommend you do so. Under the old Copyright Act, the 1909 Act, the requirement was that you always have that notice on anything you publish. If you publish without notice, your work became public domain. You lost all your rights to it. So it used to be that you had to put that on there. And just like putting butter on a burn or mailing yourself a copyright in a, mailing yourself your book in an envelope, there are people now who believe that if it doesn't have the copyright mark, that you've given up your rights to it, that you're intending for it to be freely used. That's not the case. It is just as protected legally if it has the copyright notice as if it doesn't. But you know what? Your car is just as protected legally if you lock it as if you don't. Now, most of you have parked cars here downtown Atlanta. How many of y'all left them unlocked because you knew that they were still protected? Yeah, you locked your car, so put the copyright notice on. If nothing else, it keeps honest people honest. And sometimes that's the difference between still having the radio in your car and you get back and not. So watch for that. So, but the existence, the presence or absence of the copyright notice is now irrelevant. Under this always amuses me, the 1976 Act is the current act. It went into effect in 1978. It's called the 76 Act, and it It's the 1976 Copyright Act, and it took effect January 1, 1978. It's Congress, what do you know? But under the 76 Act, anything published since then does not require notice. Copyright attaches automatically when you write it down and goes for 70 years after the author's death. Under the previous act, there were two terms, and you had to file for the first one, and you had to file your renewal at the right time, which if you wrote three novels, it's not a big deal, but if you wrote 500 newspaper articles, magazine articles, gets a little bit tricky, because there was an exact time when you had to do it within 6 months of the 19th anniversary of the publication of each individual work. So, you know, God help them, poets never could get their stuff renewed on time unless their publisher did it for them. So there were a lot of formalities then, and if you renewed it, then you got a second term. And so it's difficult often to find out if works that were published before 1976, because there was actually a break period and they grandfathered stuff from 76 to 78 in, anything published before 76, it's hard to find out if it's still covered, frankly. The copyright database is getting better and better, so you can find out more from the Library of Congress, but it's sometimes hard to find, because you have to find out, well, when was it published? Was it filed? If it was filed, was it renewed? And that's difficult information sometimes to find out. Since the 76 Act, way easier. Was it written down? Yes. Is the author alive? Yes, it's covered. Is the author dead? Yes. How recently? It's not been 70 years since the 76 Act, so everything written is fine. Even if you wrote it and died, it's still covered. Okay, you can wait.
I'd like to say a couple of things. The academic girls are doing more and more creative complexes online. I was an editorial intern for English, teaching English, and I had to do all that research for some reason when they had it.
Because that's how we get tenure.
Yeah.
We write articles that no one will ever read, but that's how we get tenure. It's important.
At my school, there is no tenure. But more and more are doing that because like a lot of the English courses and stuff are starting to create a commons so they can pull together as long as you read the Creative Commons, you can usually use it. And most people don't know that. Just always look at academic journals if you're using them for something. And you don't have to ask permission. As long as it's got it. As long as
like I said, look for the Creative Commons license, because that does mean that it's, and you can look and see which Creative, but look and see which Creative Commons license it was released under, because there's varying licenses. Some say you can use it freely, some say you can use it with attribution, some say you can use it for non-commercial, some, you know, there are various things you're allowed to do and not do. And the nice thing about the Creative Commons license is there's a big, thick legal document, which is well-drafted, and I don't say that often. In front of that legal document is a nice English summary, written for humans, not for me, that tells you what's in there. And the human language summary is accurate, which is really cool, because trust me, please do not download anything else off the internet and use it as a legal agreement, because it's crap. And they will tell you it says something and you read it and it doesn't. Now, they're not trying to cheat necessarily, they're just not very good. Lawyers that are good don't give stuff away. So if someone's giving it away on the internet, don't use it for legal advice. I mean, come on. Don't get first aid advice from the internet either. Someone will tell you to put butter on that burn. So don't trust anyone who's giving you legal advice. You know, you got to figure these guys have probably at least vetted to make sure I am a lawyer. I am. But I could say I'm a veterinarian on the internet, and I could give you advice on how to fix your pet. I might be right, or I might tell you to put butter on the burn.
There's actually a system you can actually see online. They've actually got a rating system, so you can tell right away. So.
But look at the Creative Commons licenses. Look which one it is. Look, and the summaries are accurate. So you'll know what rights you're being freely given, and you can use this stuff. And I encourage you, if you're releasing things, look at those licenses and think how you might like to release it and be able to share. I think you were next. Yeah?
Quick question. If the 1976 Copyright Act automatically applies to copyright stuff now, does that mean there's no longer a way to just publish it in the public domain if you don't care?
Creative Commons. You can give away all your rights on a Creative Commons license. You can publish it and say, use this freely. You automatically have those rights. That's one of Lessig's big criticisms of the Copyright Act. You no longer have, the default is, I am completely protected against everything. And one of the copyleft criticisms of the law is that the default should be, anyone can use it, you should have to take an affirmative step to protect your stuff. It's actually almost hard to give away the rights. And the Creative Commons license intends to do exactly that. So it is a very legal way to say, please use this. So I would encourage you to just use that. It's free. You downloaded, the forms are good, you use the captions the way they tell you to, and you will give people permission legally and accurately to use it. So that would be the easiest way to do it. That's one of the things that drove Creative Commons is people don't know how to give their stuff away because it's actually hard to legally do so. Creative Commons covers that. Yeah.
Okay. When, say for example, you have photographs, they are copyrighted.
Correct. And then, oh, not obviously. There was a big controversy about that when photographs came out. But now they're in the statute, so we're good.
Say you put them on Flickr and the Flickr says copyright because they have commons. They have a holder, and then you post them on Facebook.
I would read those EULAs before I posted anything I cared about on Flickr or Facebook, because I have not read Facebook's EULA. EULA is the end user license agreement. I have not read Facebook's today, but just like Apple, it changes it constantly, and you don't know what you've agreed to, but you're agreeing to it. And at one point, at least, you are giving away some of your copyright rights when you post it on Facebook. So if it's your family travel vacation pictures, you can keep people from using pictures of you elsewhere on the internet. But if you're a professional photographer... If you're a professional photographer, I mean, I was talking to some professional photographers yesterday, read it, because you are likely, technically, giving away your rights if you post it on Facebook. I've never read Flickr's, but it very well is likely the same thing. If you, by virtue of posting, you, that thing when you clicked I agree when you first set up your account that you didn't read?
No, you're not getting it.
Okay, well, you clicked a box that said you agree when you set up your account, and they can change what you agreed to after the fact. Everybody's going to say, oh, we've updated the agreement. If you want to continue using us, check this box. You don't know what you're agreeing to. So if it's your family snapshots and you want to share them that way, Flickr's kind of cool, and PhotoBook and all the others are neat. If you're a professional photographer, be careful, because you may be giving away your rights. Now, I have not heard of a case where Facebook actually tried to enforce those rights against a professional photographer who wants to exploit their works. And what most of the artists have come to the general consensus of is if you're posting your stuff, which you want to do to keep your fans excited, if you're a commercial artist, you want to keep putting your stuff up so your fans see what you're doing. And you post, but what the smart way to do it is on your Facebook page, say, hey, I've got a new work. Follow this link to see it and have the thing on your Facebook page. And what most of the artists are saying they're doing, the really successful ones that are doing it, still have to put their stuff on the internet because that's how they make sales. And they say they use low-res photos of it so that if someone tries to copy, they've got a crappy copy. And some of them watermark it obnoxiously. You've seen that. Now, yeah, you could sit down with Photoshop and take out the watermark, but if you don't put that much effort into it, you'd probably just buy a damn copy of it. So just make it harder, you know, lock the car door and put up a low-res version if it's a commercial artwork that you want to show but not let people copy freely. So, you know, some of it's not so much using copyright law, but using technology the best you can to share but not give away. But yeah, I read those EULAs if I'm putting up professional work. If I'm putting up a picture of my puppy, and anyone who wants to see pictures of my puppy, I'll show you after the class. But, you know, no one's going to steal the pictures of my puppy. And if they steal the pictures of my puppy, I do have rights still. But I'm not a professional photographer. If I were, I would take a very different approach to posting stuff on the internet. And like I said, lock your car doors. Doesn't mean someone's not going to steal your car. And when people say, but if copyright protects it, but someone stole this from me. It's like, well, you know, criminal law protects my car, but that doesn't mean someone's not going to steal it. People break laws. People break copyright laws, either knowingly or unknowingly. What I can tell you about enforcing your rights is how to make it so that fewer people will steal your stuff without meaning to.
Is it legal to quote movie quotes in a book? As in, you know, like, there's like the famous quotes from every movie, the famous line. If I'm writing fiction, can I have one of the characters jokingly say,
I'll be back.
Yeah, exactly. Or forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown or something along those lines.
Probably. It's okay. That's a de minimis use. It's used not in a way, if you go through the fair use factors, how much of the work are you using? What's the nature of your work? What's the nature of your use? Are you going to in any way impact their commercial profitability or their potential expansion into other markets? That's not going to hurt them any, is part of it. And it's a very small de minimis use. You're not using images from the film. You're not using, you know, anything that's going to have people go to your book instead of going to that movie.
Okay. Okay.
So that is almost certainly okay.
There's no guarantee.
But what I'm going to tell you is what if you actually publish that professionally, your publisher won't let you do it.
Okay.
Because what your publisher knows is what I'm telling you, which is it's not fair use till a judge tells you. And that means you've gone through an appellate judge, not even just a trial judge, an appellate judge before you get a real answer, and that you think a patent's expensive. Yeah, try a copyright lawsuit. So unless you have huge, deep pockets, you can't defend against the content holder's lawsuit if it comes. So no real publisher is going to do that, let you have that quote in there. They'll raise it, that's cute, take that out. Either get permission or take it out. And getting permission from real people is usually pretty easy. But whoever wrote that movie doesn't own the rights to it. Paramount owns the rights to it, and Paramount's not going to give you permission. Because if Paramount had a person who made those decisions, they would, but the movie companies never give permission to anyone. It's something documentary people come up against real hard problems with, because if you're trying to use a clip from a film, you have to get permission from everyone who is in the film, and the Screen Actors Guild, and the director, and the producer, and it's virtually impossible just to track down permissions you need. Now, chances are the guy who played the sixth Indian on the left in the spaghetti western, you know, died right after that movie, or in the movie, who knows, and doesn't care that you're using that clip that he didn't remember he was in the movie because he was an extra and was there for a day and a half. But you have to track him or his heirs down, technically get permission. Would it matter? No, they're not going to care or know, but your publisher's going to care because the publishers have all gotten burned by these lawsuits. So your publisher will not let you get away with it. My academic publisher's like, oh, come on, you're a copyright lawyer. I'm like, oh, great, this is commercial, sorry. I had to have permission for everything I used, even a 50-year-old legal article. They made me make sure I had clearance. If I were an important author, they would have done it for me, but I got clearance for each quote that I used. And that's what your publisher will make you do. From a legal standpoint, that's probably fine. But your publisher won't let you do it, because they see it as too much of a risk. Yeah?
For song lyrics, I've read even song lyrics in your books. Because those are published in the Stephen King has a lyric in Self that he changed. And I was just like, why is this lyric incorrect? And I realized it's because it was by a very famous musician.
Yeah, he only got away with that because he's Stephen King. If you still recognize the lyric, it was still infringement. It does not have to be an exact copy to be an infringement. That idea of, oh, change one or two words and it's okay, that's like mailing it to yourself. But he's Stephen King. So he, you know, if you're Stephen King, I'm going to give you different answers, but I don't see Stephen King in here, but I'm not sure I'd recognize him. Okay, I have time for, I think, one more question, but I have two people. Okay, ask a really short question, so I'll try to get you both in.
What if you're using like a parody between two different things?
Okay, parody is not in the statute, but it's kind of been read into the statute. Parody is, or satire, is a fair use that has gotten a lot of expansion because one lawyer who's here, local, who got a really bad piece of law passed. But regardless, parody is usually okay, but there are limits. You can only use as much of the copyrighted work as you have to. You can't just do it. For instance, there was a case where someone was doing an O.J. Simpson, was making fun of the O.J. Simpson case using Dr. Seuss verse. Dr. Seuss verse has nothing to do with O.J. Simpson. That was infringement. I don't know what you could do for O.J. Simpson to be okay, but yeah. But so parody is okay, but only if you do it correctly. Use as little of that work as you can.
Well, this shirt's a good example.
That's probably copyright infringement.
And it's Pokemon.
Yeah, it's probably a copyright. It's probably infringement of two different copyrights.
Mm-hmm. Any advice for independent filmmakers?
Make good films? But I'm sorry.
In regards to copyrighting their material, especially posting on YouTube and things like that.
I would copyright it. I would file it before I post it, if you can. If you're doing lots of little clips, you know, there's practical limits to good legal advice. I can tell you the best legal practice is to file it before you post it. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't, but watch where you're posting it because you may be giving your rights away. Be careful about that. And I think that means I'm out.
Okay.
Okay, one more.
I just had a question on the copywriting concepts that you have created within your novel. Like, for instance, races, like, forced goblins.
Okay, stuff within your novel. That's a good question. If I were Tolkien and I created hobbits and all of those things, well, he didn't, but we give him credit for it. He pulled it from folklore, but that's okay. He was the first one to really publish it. Anything I create in my novel is part of my copyright, but what's not part of my copyright is the underlying idea. So the idea of tall guys that do magic and live a long time, okay, that's too general. people called elves with pointy ears and names like this with no vowels in them and, you know, stuff like that. There's a line between which something is an unprotectable idea from your book and a line where it's identifiable. Kid who doesn't know who his parents are is growing up in unfortunate circumstances and through happenstance and strange adventures discovers he is either magical or the heir to the kingdom. Okay, I just described what, every fantasy book? But if I make it in London at his uncle's house and he has a lightning-shaped scar on his forehead and wears little round glasses and goes to a magical academy, there's a point where you recognize what book I'm talking about. When you recognize the book I'm talking about, it's protected. Star-crossed lovers, well, yeah, there have been a few books about that. If I start talking about, you know, Capulets, and I start talking about, are you biting your thumb? Yay, I bite my thumb, but not at these, sir. At some point, you recognize the work. That point where you recognize the work is where it's protected. Before you get to that point of, oh, that book, then it's just the idea behind your book. Ideas are not protectable. Your expression of the idea is. J.K. Rowling took the traditional book, the traditional fantasy story, and made a very distinct, unique version of it. I almost have 30 seconds to tell you the... Just every time I talk about Rowling's book, I have to think about my mother, who is not a fan of this genre at all, who has been exposed to exactly two pieces of sci-fi and fantasy. One was Star Wars, one was Harry Potter. As she was reading Harry Potter, she's like, well, this is a knockoff of Star Wars.
What? No.
Young kid doesn't know his parents. Through happenstance discovers he has strange magical abilities, goes on to save the world. Even the big scary bad guy's name starts with a V. I'm like, damn, it's the same story. Now, I wouldn't have thought so, because, you know, to us, that's a completely different story. But, you know, so there's your infringement. So the races you create, big things that talk like trolls, you know, that idea, not protected. Your distinct take on it, protected. That makes sense? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
But you don't need to file a separate copyright for each of those. It's in the work that you publish.
The one thing I was trying to do is lightsabers. Why is he able to just, I mean, it's the word light and saber. It's kind of...
Luke is probably trademarked.
It is. That's what I'm saying.
That's different. That's not copyright. That's trademark. That is identifying the source of that movie. That lightsaber is part of the identification of Lucasfilm's products.
Okay.
So it's a different thing. But otherwise, yes. Plus, you know, it makes that noise, and he somehow has managed to make a laser stop. Okay, we have to stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you.